With me here today is Mark Snyderhan, who is a board-certified psychiatric pharmacist who's been providing psychiatric pharmacy consultations and teachings since 1994. He is currently faculty at the University of Minnesota Duluth and is very active in his clinical practice at the Human Development Center in Duluth, Minnesota. And I am very glad to have him with me here today.
Yeah, it's a pleasure being here.
So, tell me a little bit about yourself and the clinical setting you work in.
Okay. I'm a board-certified psychiatric pharmacist, and I work in community mental health. But I also am faculty at the University of Minnesota College of Pharmacy, so about 40%, 50% of my time is teaching and research scholarly activities, and then the rest of the time is service, like practice service and being in the clinic. And I do direct patient care. I'm part of the psychiatry department. And so I have a collaborative practice agreement with the psychiatrist, which makes that unique as well. So I prescribe under a protocol. And I can describe that if you want. I pretty much stick to just psychotropic medications or medications that have that niche or utility. Maybe it might be a cardiovascular medication that we can use for mental health reasons. But so the other thing that I don't do is I don't start new medications that are controlled substances. Mm-hmm. So I work with a nurse practitioner. I work with an RN. It's really multidisciplinary. I have social work that I work with. Part of the Human Development Center is very unique in itself. It's a nonprofit. They have an assertive community treatment team, which incorporates all these different disciplines from like employment specialists to substance use disorder specialists and therapists and psychiatrists, nurse practitioner, RN, I mean, and they all do case management. It's a case management approach to patients who are these people who just end up in the hospital over and over again, and the system just isn't built to take care of them. So we have this group, this it's assertive community treatment team, which takes about 100 patients. And so I'm part of that as well. So okay. I do general psychiatry, more adult, and then assertive community treatment team. I'm in Duluth. I'm also in Superior. I go up to Cloquet when I'm called to. Most of my patients are referred to me from the psychiatrists or the nurse practitioners, I would say. Mm-hmm. I've been getting some county referrals. I've been getting some outside referrals, which I have a process for handling that as well. So, you know, it's fun because I don't get the routine cases either. Yeah. So I get the cases that they've tried everything. They're just not sure what's next, or that it requires a lot of visits. And I have the luxury of maybe seeing the patient more often and trying to get their meds sorted out in the initial like stages, because sometimes the initial stages of medication treatment are so crucial because that's when side effects happen. Yeah. A lot of the monitoring happens in the beginning, but also throughout.
So the Human Development Center, is that like a community clinic then?
Oh, yeah.
And it's in Duluth?
Yes.
Yeah, Duluth, Minnesota. Yep. And so that's where you're practicing out of primarily, and then you work at the school, College of Pharmacy as well.
And the Human Development Center actually covers a lot of Northeast Minnesota. Yeah. If you think about it, it goes all the way up to Grand Marais, goes almost all the way to Hibbing, so into the Iron Range. It's a pretty big organization as far as coverage.
When we think about integrative mental health, how do you kind of see that fitting or coming into your work?
Well, I think that it's very, very important to have a lot of resources at my disposal. You know, I work with a lot of different disciplines. My patients are fairly complex as far as and chronic, and the chronicity of it really lends to some of the complexities. And so they've been treated, they haven't had much success, or caregivers are burnt out, or the group homes or where they're placed, maybe there's a lot of frustration maybe. So trying to work with staff and that. But I think for me, how my approach to in my practice is about when I have a patient come in, I tell them that, you know, I'm a pharmacist, but I specialize in psychiatry, but I also look at all your medications, but I also look at it from a not just mental health standpoint. I'm looking at how the medications are working physically. Yeah. I'm looking at how they especially may impact you as far as side effects. Actually, a lot of people are worried about medications because of the side effects. We see it on TV. We see a commercial, and there's a disclaimer that goes, you know, and all these things, bad things can happen. So I see my job is to really try to look at the risk and benefit and talk to them specifically around that. So I do one-on-one, face-to-face is my preferred way of communicating. And I take families in. I've had families. I've had guardians. I commonly have staff people accompanying patients or see them alone, depending on the situation.
So how do you see it being related to your work when we think about this kind of whole systems or integrative approach to mental health?
Well, as I was talking about the pharmacist approach, I define my approach as comprehensive medication management, which is an approach that is patient-centered. And being patient-centered, it's trying to make sure that the patient's on the right medication for the right condition at the right dose, that they're not having side effects, that they're willing to take it. And what other factors are going on that could impact this medication therapy? And I work with a lot of, like, these adult foster care homes, and so patients will come to me, like maybe even young patients who are in their 20s or 30s, or elderly patients who have behavioral problems. Yeah. And a lot of times the behavioral problems can be traced back to stressors or triggers that happen in the home. Staff turnover, new things going on, maybe the milieu, which is kind of the sense. If you walk into the room, you can tell if it's really tense or if it's relaxed. And if the milieu is very chaotic, that can also, you know, drive some of the other behaviors that are happening. And I got to tell you, I have young kids. And so when one cries, it seems like they all cry. That's kind of it's that phenomena, you know, that happens. And so being aware of that, and actually I even have the staff people record when those kind of issues happen in relationship to any med changes, so we can differentiate what's happening with a med change versus things that go on that could trigger behaviors or things like that. And so I've had them provide me with monthly graphs of how things are going from behavioral standpoint, so I can actually start to wean them off. A lot of times I'm trying to wean them off of meds, and there's a lot of anxiety about coming off of meds. And so patients get on multiple meds because of anxiety, because the staff's anxiety, because of safety issues, because they don't know what to do. And so meds get added on but never taken off. And so a lot of my focus has been to see how to do small dose reductions in a thoughtful way, but not put everyone at unease because I'm going to just take them all off their meds, but do it in a way that might take some time. And I tell them this might take some time. I'm not going to try to get you off this med in 6 months or, you know, this might take, maybe we'll do a dose adjustment or reduction yearly. There's not data to support this. But the one thing that's clear is that medications, especially the antipsychotic category of medications that we're overusing and were being combined together. So you're seeing multiple medications in the same class being used together with no evidence. But you get that N-of-1. You get that patient who decompensates when you start to take them off of medications, whether it's too fast or, you know, there's so many factors in. So one of the things that happens in mental health is that if a patient's stable, if it's not broken, don't fix it, kind of attitude. But also it does, to me, it's not in the best interest for the patient to give them, you know, the best chance to be on the lowest effective dose, which is kind of how I was brought up and trained in my field because of the side effect risk. And I can go on more about that, because that's kind of how I had this kind of transformation from my training over the years to really focus on adverse medication effects or side effects. So
yeah. We're having this discussion and we're seeing different approaches to integrated mental health and different perceptions of it. But one of the key principles of integrated mental health is the lowest possible level of intrusiveness. No, I think it's an important discussion to have. Can you talk a little bit more about that and how you kind of see that manifested in your practice?
You know, I was thinking of some examples when we were talking before. Yeah. You know, okay, so I have a client of mine, and she's has a history of great education, had great work practice. She was in higher management and this big company, and all of a sudden something happened where she couldn't work anymore. And she's a young woman in her middle aged, and because of the mental illness that she was unable to work. And so I started working with her for the past 4 years, and I'm doing other things with her. But one of the things that I've tried to look at, and this is where the integrative piece is that I'm aware of other support systems. She has a therapist, but also there's help for caregivers, especially those who are suffering if they have family members who have substance use disorders like alcohol. Yeah. I mean, there's Al-Anon, which is for the family of alcoholics, for them to handle that kind of living situation, because it's very chaotic living with someone with an addiction. Yeah. And even if the person is right in the home, or if they're miles away, if it affects their mental health, then it's on my table too, because I'm trying to manage this problem not with medications, but also looking at what happens when my medications don't work, or what level can I get this person at. So I had one client who, you know, I do this routinely because I do look at history and kind of trace back, like, what are those psychosocial factors that could manifest into anxiety or depression and that may exacerbate more an endogenous kind of depression that could be going on as well. Or it could be a psychosis or bipolar disorder for that matter. And there's a lot of factors that can trigger either depression or mania or psychosis in patients. And so keeping aware of that is really important. So I have one patient who started doing it online. So she had a way. She didn't want to go out to a group, but she was able to connect with people online and start to get some help. And also trying to encourage them when I see them to remind them that you said last time it was helpful, but now what is keeping you from continuing doing it? What has gotten in the way, you know? Sometimes in this one patient, it was more physical problems, pain. Yeah. And I see a lot of pain and pain is an interesting deal as far as from a mental health perspective, because I got to tell you that when you have a patient in pain, and I do assess for pain, that you have to really keep that in the back of your mind. I've seen patients get agitated, become violent from pain. I've seen patients' depression get worse. I've seen actually diabetes, some of their physical health symptoms. Memory can be affected because of depression, anxiety, and worry about pain.
Yeah.
And then you have the treatment, which is kind of, so you have opiates. And like the Vicodins and the Lortabs and those kind of medications, which really can impact their day life. If especially
their mental health symptoms.
Their mental health symptoms. And I have a patient who I'm trying to wean, working with a primary care provider to get her off the Lortabs for her back pain. And she said this last visit, she told me, this medication is not a psychotropic. You lied to me. It's not a psychotropic medication. And I said, it really is a psychotropic medication because it works at the brain. It might be for pain, but it can cause some major problems as far as your withdrawal and there's a lot of physical problems from chronic opiate use, and I don't need probably, unless you want me to, go into it. Recently I had a patient who was, he's like early 60s, lived with his mom for many, many years. He had a has a developmental disorder. Okay. And so he was at birth and so wasn't able to leave, and his mother cared for him until he was in his late 50s, and then it came to the point where she couldn't do it anymore. But then he was hospitalized because of behaviors, and they thought that he had Alzheimer's, so they put him on Alzheimer's medications. Sure. and benzodiazepines and antidepressants all at once. And then he had urinary incontinence, and they thought that was part of the behavior.
Yeah.
And I just saw him last week, and I told the primary care, because I wasn't the one who ordered the Napazole,
sure,
the Alzheimer's medication. Yeah. And we were able to stop it, and the behavior stopped, actually, after we stopped the medication. So he wasn't urinating in the downstairs living room or,
sure,
hallway.
Yeah.
where he was still having episodes of incontinence, but it wasn't happening in places that would make it hard to manage. You know? And so it's amazing what these medications, even at small doses, and what benefit was he getting? So I kind of look at it from, what benefit are you getting? What side effects can happen? So looking,
sure,
at it from a pharmacology standpoint, how these medicines work. So I have students with me.
Yeah.
So we talk a lot about how these medications work, because when I make selections about medications, I think very deeply about these medications, about how they work,
right,
in the brain, how they work with other medications, how they interact, how they work on the liver that breaks down these medications. Does it,
sure,
does it slow down that liver from breaking down, or speed it up?
Mm-hmm.
What can we do to enhance or capitalize on other treatments, like using an antidepressant to treat neuropathic pain,
sure,
with depression,
yeah,
or migraine, and maybe mood stabilizing effects, like with divalproic sodium, something like,
yeah,
that.
Sure.
Depakote, yeah, to try to capitalize on anti-migraine, maybe,
sure,
maybe mood stabilization. But then you get into the side effects issues. So I've recommended, like, maybe vitamins sometimes to counteract some of the hair loss with Depakote, because,
sure,
there's this negative side of it too.
Yeah.
There's weight gain, and you mentioned weight gain to patients, and they're going to balk on your,
yeah,
treatment.
Yeah.
And so having a plan around weight gain, and actually that's kind of where I really got into the side effect issue, because when one of the drug companies came out with this new antipsychotic medication back in the late 90s, my patients were developing diabetes,
yeah,
all of a sudden, where they weren't, and they were gaining weight. And they were saying,
yeah,
I had a husband tell me that his wife started going down the middle of the night and pulling a chair up to the refrigerator and started eating. And then the next day she was hospitalized in diabetic ketoacidosis,
yeah,
almost in a coma.
Yeah.
And she never had diabetes. And it was like, this is something wrong.
Yeah.
And so that kind of got me started, that there's something going on here. And the company's not really saying that. They're saying that it's the disease, their mental illness, that's causing the diabetes. And there is some evidence for that, but not, you know, I was in practice at that point for about 5 years, and then I did 2 years of residency,
yeah,
and fellowship in psychiatry, and you know, I wasn't seeing that stuff happening. And I was using the old meds. Now these new meds came out in the 90s. And the 90s was like a 90s and the early 2000s. Those were big years for new meds that came, yeah, out.
You're so, talking about the atypical antipsychotics.
Yeah, antipsychotics,
right?
Yeah, 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 you know,
yeah,
right, exactly. And that kind of changed how we treat schizophrenia and how we monitor patients for some of the side effects. I think some of the residents, I think we became a little lazy about looking at side effects such,
yeah,
as the neurologic side effects, such as tardive dyskinesia, which is an irreversible side effect, very,
yeah,
stigmatizing,
yeah,
where a person could actually
and can
have
certainly how it can certainly happen with the newer,
oh, yeah,
newer ones as well. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So we need to be vigilant with that. We need to be, I have to be vigilant about metabolic issues,
yeah,
diabetes, weight gain. In fact, I even felt seriously about, I did a study and I included in my bio that I just published on just trying to do point of care testing on diabetes in,
yeah,
in the mental health center.
Yeah.
And try to work with primary care. Try to connect with primary care through recommendations and maybe how to improve medication therapy in these patients. And so it was a tough issue. there's some major hurdles that I found doing the study. So,
if we talk a little bit about herbal remedies, some of the amino acid derivatives like SAMe, some of the herbals I'm thinking about, St. John's Wort or Calva or something like that. What's your experience working with that? How can you talk a little bit about that, how that comes into your practice?
St. John's Wort, usually the patients I see are beyond the stage for St. John's Wort. Yeah. St. John's Wort is really something for mild depression.
Yeah.
And it's for someone who's not on any other medications, relatively healthy, because the St. John's Wort has many drug interactions that we have to be very, very careful about, and especially... Let me give you an example. A woman on birth control pills wants to take St. John's Wort. Well, it's taking a chance that you might become pregnant.
Yeah,
that's how this is one of those meds that actually makes the liver work harder. So your meds don't work at the same level. And St. John's, so you have to be aware of that. Also, the combination of St. John's Wort with some of the other antidepressants could be risky and can lead to side effects. So. Herbal medications are not benign. They're chemicals. They can change how the liver works. Yeah. They can change how other medications are distributed or how they're eliminated in the body. And it's something that I take very seriously. I don't typically recommend a lot of the herbals, but I'm very aware of vitamin D and its role. I think that vitamin, and I call it a drug because it is, technically, and we think of vitamins as not drugs, but they are.
Yeah.
And it's a fat-soluble vitamin, and being in the northern climates, we don't get a lot of sun, and I've seen vitamin D levels very, very low, especially and it's concerning in patients with depression. And so getting them on vitamin D is really part of the treatment. Even if you had them on antidepressant medications, you have to start focusing on that as well. So vitamins, actually, it's kind of interesting because the thing that got me into psychiatry was vitamin E. Maybe there's a role for it, but I haven't been using vitamin E, but I do vitamin D. Sometimes low doses of selenium and zinc if patients have like hair loss from Depakote, I've made those recommendations. Melatonin actually is one that I use the most. I don't really go into valerian or the other ones. I just don't have enough experience with those.
Sure.
And the problem is for me is that I'm not sure exactly what the potency of each batch is in these herbal products. So you may have a lot, a batch. And batches are basically a manufacturer puts out a certain amount of product, they give it a number, and they manufacture it. Well, from batch to batch, there's no regulation on how much of the herb that could be put in the capsule or whatever. So you may have differences in potency from batch to batch or from company to company. So if you switch companies... Yeah. All bets are off. So you don't have that kind of protection with some of the herbal.
They're not FDA regulated.
Exactly.
And so the quality control often isn't there.
Yep. Exactly. Yeah. And these are kind of talking points, education points to patients, not to say that you can't use them.
Sure.
It's just you just have to come in with your eyes open about what we know, what we don't know.
Using a whole systems approach, and you've described someone just thinking about different systems and environmental factors that can really have an impact. And it's not always just about the neurotransmitter. It's also about the wife or the husband or the job
taking into account substance use disorder. Yeah. Also utilizing light therapy. I've written letters to get patients a light box because there's some good evidence. And now we're finding as we're using it more blue light therapy, if a person has risk for cataracts, that it could raise the risk for cataracts. So we have to be careful. Even something like bright light therapy, which is like a half hour every, if you're going to use it, depending on how you're going to use it, you have to be aware of what the risks are even for light therapy and side effects. So even that is not... you have to think about, I think about even therapy. If a patient goes into therapy, there's side effects to being in a one-to-one therapy because of things that get brought up or things that have been suppressed.
And time and money as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So there's no such thing as a free lunch with any of these things.
No. In one case, the patient's on multiple medications, and I brought up the idea of going on a long-acting injection for an antipsychotic.
Sure.
And he really embraced that idea, thought that was a great idea, because every time he became suicidal, he would stop his medications.
Yeah.
And he had access to insulin. So this was a very serious kind of patient who would overdose on his insulin, and that could be very fatal. That gets my attention when someone has insulin and they're not very well controlled and they have a lot of insulin. The primary care provider was only giving them a week's supply of insulin, but there's only so much you can do.
Yeah.
I got this gentleman on some long-acting injection, and knock on wood, he really likes it, and so I'm backing off the oral. I'm going to get him off the oral, and maybe off the other antipsychotic that he's on.
Yeah.
But we'll see. Sometimes I get a little excited and talk about what and patients. You know, you have to be careful just by getting too excited about early response too, and just say we're taking this slow. They want to be reassured that it's not going to all come back if they're feeling better, and so. One of my challenges is sometimes you get into this situation where there's a lot of fear.
Yeah.
A lot of fear around, you know, what would happen if my symptoms would come back.
Yeah.
Or what would happen if I'm not on these medications, would I need to be seen? Would I be like then not a patient anymore?
Right.
This whole fear of maybe losing that role. There's a lot of It's a very powerful role to be in as a patient, and it's a very dependent role.
To
be on medications.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of symbolism to be on medications, and a lot of it is somewhat negative and stigmatizing as well. So I'm hoping that the stigma part, it gets better. But we look in the news, and it's happening all the time, where suicide and issues around depression are cropping up, violence or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
We need to start to really look seriously at that. Funding has not been very good in psychiatry.
That's true.
And we're losing our adult foster care homes in Minnesota, so I'm very concerned about the way it's heading as far as caring for patients. So it's going to be real interesting.
Is there anything you want to add in the end? We've talked a lot about a lot of things.
You know, just one thing I wanted to just tell you about, which I didn't as far as my approach.
And so
my approach compared to nursing and psychiatrists, you're kind of wondering, because I was kind of trained like a psychiatrist in my early days, but I decided that there was a lot of literature. Actually, the University of Minnesota had some of the best literature around how a pharmacist should practice it, and gave us a practice for pharmacists.
Okay.
And this practice basically is this patient-centered care approach, which looks at all the conditions, all the medications, and then also identifies drug therapy problems. So my approach is when I talk to patients is to tell them that I'm, you know, here to help identify problems with your meds. In my mind, that's what I look at. I list those drug therapy problems, and I also keep track on how we're doing. Am I making a difference on that? So I've been keeping track of that for myself so I can see that difference. So I have to keep in mind the symptoms and the diagnosis, but also what is the role of the medications? Is it too much? Is it too little?
Yeah.
Is there a drug interaction? So I just want to make that point that my approach is that way. I probably said it already,
good to clarify.
That.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming
you're welcome.
And talking to me. It was great.
Thank you for having me.